Support for MPB comes from the Mississippi Museum of Art in Jackson. What Became of Dr. Smith by artist Noah Satterstrom is on view beginning April 20th. Learn more at msmuseumart.org.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast.
Welcome to the Mississippi Arts Hour on MPB Radio, where each week we talk to a musician, artist, author, or other creative Mississippian working in the arts across the state. I'm your host, Melody Moody Thordis, Director of Grants at the Mississippi Arts Commission. And today I'm speaking with dancer Candace Salyers. Candace, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I want to talk to you a little bit about growing up and how you came to the existence that you are now as a dancer. But tell our audience, before we dive deep, a little bit about yourself, what you're currently doing.
Yes, well, I am a dance artist, and I think about that very broadly, that my work, my artistic work always includes dance. It always includes movement in some way or a movement exploration that helps me understand something more about humanity or about myself or about the world. And specifically, my work right now is really looking at how can dance practices be used to bring or help to bring more dignity to human life, and how can they be a means of humanitarian service. So a lot of the work that I do as an artist now is focused on helping other people dance when they haven't maybe had the opportunities to do so, because certainly participation and expression through the arts is one way that human beings experience dignity and experience and empowerment, as well as using my own performing to highlight issues or ideas or understandings about our world. And specifically for me right now, that's been very environmentally focused and considering the relationship between human beings and landscapes, as well as the relationships between different groups of human beings and how dance can actually be a means of peacemaking between people and between humans and our natural environments.
Well, I want to really dig into all of that. Let me start at the beginning. So where did you grow up?
I actually grew up in a small town. It used to be a small town. It's not anymore. Right outside of Nashville, Tennessee. And it's a place, it's called Hendersonville, and it's a place where a lot of...
Yes,
Johnny Cash was a member of my church. I was going to say, watching him perform in church was one of my early formative memories, actually, because at the time I didn't understand that he was world famous as a performer. I just thought he was well known in the congregation, but he had a particular way of performing. And I think you'll hear, members of his family speak about this too, that there was something transmitted through him when he was in a state of performance that was very profound and very sacred. And so I do actually count him as one of my early influences as a performer, that it seeing him perform in that way and feeling that kind of transmission from a performer really shaped what I thought was possible through performance.
I actually grew up just a stone's throw away from the Carter Fold. and he would perform there sometimes, and Marty Stewart would perform there. And of course, with June Carter's family.
Yes.
And the Carter family. So I can relate to the other side of that as well. That's amazing. That's part of why I knew about the Hendersonville connection growing up in kind of that area as well. So tell me about your early creative experiences.
Well, my mother put me into ballet classes as a child, and I'm very grateful to her for doing that, and I'm very grateful that I had the opportunity to do that. And as a young child, I didn't enjoy it very much. I kind of didn't like to be told what to do, and so I was always... Not that I was always fidgeting at the bar or on the ballet bar or something, but I was always engaged in movement beyond what was being asked of me. So as I grew up, I started to understand, well, there are many ways that we can be dancers in the world. and I've had the great benefit also of then studying other world dance traditions, where spontaneous dance, what we might call improvisational dance here, can have many functions in a culture and in a community. So even though I wasn't necessarily the best student as a four-year-old in my ballet class, I feel like those early opportunities did give me a chance to develop a kinesthetic language and understanding that then I could apply in other ways. But I also, I would say one of the things that really shaped me as an artist was hearing a story in church actually about there was an offering plate being passed through the congregation, and it came to a woman who didn't have any money to put in it. And so she placed the offering plate on the floor and stood inside of it and said that she would be the offering. And it was like at that moment I knew what my role was in the world. I felt like, oh, that's what I want to be when I grow up. I want to be an offering. And so I think I was searching for a long time for how as an artist can I become that offering, which certainly as a woman has a lot of complexity to it, but in our culture. But thinking about and reminding myself continuously that being given this gift of dance, it's also given through me for other purposes, that I want to continually remind myself that my work is to be an offering.
So you were put in ballet classes fairly young. So do you feel like it's an art form? I mean, obviously you chose it. You articulated very well your experience with it and why you chose it. But was it chosen for you in the beginning, or was it something you felt yourself drawn to even at such a young age?
Well, I loved to dance at a young age, even much younger than four. I remember I would steal slash borrow my older sister's leotard, and I would go into our kitchen and put on music and just spin around for forever. And it's interesting now that one of the world dance traditions I practice involves that kind of spinning. But I feel like as a child, I understood that dance has really sacred properties to it, and that part of dance, I feel like, chose me, and I chose it very naturally. I had to learn how to be with dance and be in dance in more codified structures. But as I said, those techniques have definitely benefited me and helped me develop greater understanding of movement and of how dance can function in the world.
So you grew up in Hendersonville. Where do you kind of where do you go to undergrad?
I went to the University of Memphis.
Okay. I'm discovering what's getting you, inching you closer to Mississippi.
Well, actually, there's been a big detour, so we'll talk.
Wonderful. Well, tell me about it. Tell me about Memphis. Tell me about the detour.
Well, I did not go to college to be a dancer. I actually was very sure that I would be a doctor. That's what I had wanted to be my whole life, in addition to an offering. On a philosophical level, I wanted to be an offering. On a really practical level, I wanted to be a doctor. So I entered school pre-med, and actually as a math major. And at the same time, I was really involved in the dance program there. And there are wonderful people in the dance program at the University of Memphis who are still there 20 years later. At the time that I was there, Moira Logan and Holly Lau were really directing that department, and they welcomed me in, whether I was a major or not, and helped me get a broader understanding of dance and the way that it can engage in the world, and especially the way that it can engage in the community. At the time, Holly had really started to develop not just dance as a way of knowing, but dance as a means of helping many, many different people learn more about themselves and engage with each other across differences. So I was very captivated by that work, and I still did not graduate as a dance major. I ended up getting an interdisciplinary degree where I was looking at how do music and dance and visual art maintain the real rigor that they have as professional artistic practices and studio practices, and at the same time have relevance for the world outside the studio and for people who are not professional artists. I've always been really interested in both of those things, that there can be excellence in the practice and also that it can be accessible and available for many, many people, not only for the professional artists.
Mm-hmm. So did you end up, you said a detour, so, did you end up, you know, pursuing a path as a doctor, or tell me more about this detours?
No, it's so interesting. I ended up, because I had not focused solely on dance as an undergraduate, I ended up going to graduate school for dance. And I went to Massachusetts. I moved to Massachusetts. And then after I graduated from graduate school, I moved actually to Wisconsin. There was a woman, a choreographer there, who was also a really brilliant solo artist and performer. And I was captivated by her work as a soloist, so I went and auditioned for her company so that I could be close to her and sort of study how she did things as a performer. Because sort of like Johnny Cash, she was one of those really magical human beings when she was on stage, and you could feel the transmission of whatever she was bringing through to the audience on a much deeper level than we might intend to put into choreography. So I moved to Madison, Wisconsin, and I danced with her for a while. And then I actually ended up taking a teaching job in New Hampshire. So I moved back to New England. And I stayed in New England for quite a while, for about 12, 13 years, and lived in Massachusetts most of that time. Started developing a lot of site work in New England, all over New England, Vermont and Massachusetts and Maine. And then I moved to Los Angeles. And which was a major detour. And I was actually thinking about that earlier today, that having grown up in the South, I always actually loved to return to the South. And I felt like there was something more for me to do here. I just wasn't sure what it was. So when I was living in Los Angeles, I had left a teaching job at a university in Massachusetts and moved to Los Angeles, and I was writing a book, and I was loving Los Angeles. California is such an amazing place. But I started to miss teaching as well. So I was looking for teaching jobs, and I began interviewing at universities in the South. And it started to feel like the door was opening for me to come back to the South. And I was really thrilled. Can we talk about faith on this
program? Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Sure.
So I was interviewing a lot of different places, not only in the South, but also in California and Pennsylvania and Massachusetts, many different places. And I finally got to the place where I was so exhausted with all of those applications and all of the interview processes that I just said, okay, I surrender. Like, I said this prayer of just send me where I can be of service. And the very next day, I got contacted by the University of Southern Mississippi.
Wow.
to come interview. So it felt really interesting and exciting, and a new pathway that was opening up for me. But at the same time, when I told artists in California that I was going to interview in Mississippi, I had this heartbreaking experience where one of them said, oh, don't go there. You don't want to go there. You don't want to be in the South. And of course, because for some reason, I've always had this accent. My Southern accent hasn't ever been very pronounced, even as a child. So a lot of times I am privy to people saying disparaging things about the South because they don't realize that I'm from the South. Mm-hmm. So it just was very heartbreaking to me, not just for, you know, thinking about how that reflects on the South, but thinking about this other artist in California just doesn't know. The only thing that she perceives are problems in the South. And certainly, like everywhere else in the United States and everywhere else in the world, there are a lot of difficulties. I mean, we have a lot of work to do as human beings all over the world. But I was really excited, actually, to come back to the South and to start doing more work, more artwork that's invested in this place.
Hi, I'm Melody Moody Thortis, and you're listening to the Mississippi Arts Hour podcast. You can also hear the show on MPB Think Radio every Sunday afternoon at 5 p.m. To hear all our conversations with creative Mississippians, be sure to subscribe to the Mississippi Arts Hour podcast on your favorite podcasting app.
Contractor ever tell you of the price of something and it sounds so high you think, maybe I'll try it myself. Some jobs just aren't that difficult, and yes, you can do it. If you want to find out how to do those things, listen to Fix It 101, podcast everywhere.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast.
You're listening to the Mississippi Arts Hour on MPB Radio. Each week on the Arts Hour, representatives from the Mississippi Arts Commission speak with different creative Mississippians. Today I'm speaking with dancer and creative Candace Salyers. So Candace, when we last left, you had made your way to taking a job at the University of Southern Mississippi. For people who don't know, tell our listeners a little bit about the dance department there.
Well, the dance program is a really beautiful, rigorous BFA, a Bachelor of Fine Arts in both choreography and performance or in dance education. So all of our students get a lot of training in creating dances, in performing dances, and also all of them get training in how to teach. So because that's something that I think my colleagues and I have all found, that being strong in all of those areas is important for how we engage in the world as dancers. And also, I've had the opportunity to develop a lot of service learning courses in the past couple of years there, which means that I'm also looking at how can our performing and our choreographic work and our teaching make significant partnerships in the community.
Yeah, that's something that I'm particularly interested in. So why don't we use that as a way to talk about some of your service learning that you've incorporated. I know that you have had some of your students work with the Leaps of Faith program. Tell us some about that and any other kind of community-focused work that you've done, particularly as it relates to dance.
Yes. So we've been able to have two really great semester-long partnerships with Leaps of Faith, two different courses. One that is a freshman ballet course in which we went and performed for the little girls who are part of the Leaps of Faith program. It's a program for young girls where they are offered ballet classes for free. So we went and performed, my students performed for them, and then we also helped to sort of tutor them in performance with a dance that they were learning. And not only was it a great joy and a reinvigoration for us, but I saw how those connections between generations have a big impact on what people think is possible for themselves. So it had a big impact on my students and what they think they can do in the world through dance. But also hearing from Laura Catherine Dawson, who's the program director at Leaps of Faith, she created the whole program, hearing from her about the response of the little girls and what they now think is possible for themselves, that they didn't know that they could go to college and study dance and train to do this in the world. And so seeing that mutual benefit has been really exciting. And then with the advanced ballet class this semester, we've been able to partner again. It's virtual, so we're doing lots of back and forth, sending videos and notes and encouraging words. But my students are working not only to perform or share their work in classical ballet with the young girls, but also they are designing a way to teach those girls a classical variation. So the advanced students have learned a very difficult classical ballet variation that they're then distilling down to its essence and figuring out how to teach that to someone who has much less ballet experience than they do. And it's been really beautiful to see the ways in which they're thinking about and connecting with and encouraging the young girls.
Well, I know I'm jumping around chronologically, but you've done some work with Camp Steady and for programs for homeless children, and then that led to you founding an organization of artists working to kind of find the intersection of their art and service. So tell us a little bit about Tell us a little bit more about those experiences.
Yes. I mean, I have to say the children who were part of Camp Steady were some of the greatest teachers I've ever had. The ways in which they engaged with dance and also the ways in which they respected not only the art form, but anything that I brought into them changed my perspective on how to respect dance myself. And I remember this was many years ago, so I was using CDs. We were playing music off of CDs, dating myself a little bit. So I had brought a CD in, and I happened to be passing it around the circle because I just didn't have another object to pass around the circle when we were engaged in this warm-up game. So I was using a CD, and it was a CD that had been in the back of my car. I think I had tossed it back there, you know, just sort of carelessly. And when I passed it around the circle, the way in which the children handled it and treated it with such care and such respect, it made me realize that there are so many things I take for granted, or that I treat as disposable, like a CD, that someone else has the capacity to demonstrate a great amount of care and respect for that. So it changed my way of being, and I feel like I will never forget that the way they handled that CD is the way I want to handle everything. To treat everything as precious and with respect. And so I often talk to my students now about, you know, if we're touching another dancer, how are we doing that? Are we doing that with the utmost care and respect? Because pre-COVID, certainly we do a lot of lifting or partner work that involves having to push against or pull against or lift another human. And the ways in which we engage with that quality of touch means something. So those children at Camp Steady changed my perspective completely to this day.
What would you say to, I was going to say a young person, but really any person, any artist who wants to get involved with helping their community, with using their art as a way to move the needle or to express their vision or feelings about any, you know, humanitarian effort or community project?
Yeah, I mean, I think first I would invite us all to remember or to connect with what do we think is possible through our art form? Because sometimes we might feel a little bit like we have to fight to get our art form recognized or appreciated. And if we weren't fighting, what would we use that energy for? And so my real passion is rerouting that. It's not that we have to fight to get what we're doing appreciated by someone who's not appreciating it. We have to see for ourselves what do we believe it can do and then put it into that channel. So I have definitely found, and I think this is so true of Mississippi. I mean, I remember maybe a year after I came to Mississippi, one of our community partners at Habitat for Humanity telling me that Mississippi is actually the highest, for many years, has been the highest ranked in the United States for charitable giving, which seems amazing, considering that we also in Mississippi face a lot of challenges, especially economic challenges. So I think of it in a similar way, that what can we give to our community or to someone through our artwork? Because those gifts that we've been given as artists are actually useful. I think sometimes I find that artists believe they need to do something outside of their art in order to benefit the community, instead of recognizing that those very gifts they have as an artist can absolutely be what they bring to their community. And certainly there are other cultures that I've had the pleasure to work in where dance is understood to be a community service. So, and especially in particular ritual forms where you can't force it or fake it. If the dance comes through you, you've been chosen to be the one that carries that dance into the community. and that's really valued and appreciated as a means of collective healing, but also as a collective responsibility. So I think, you know, one of the things I've been thinking a lot about is what is my responsibility, and in what ways am I implicated in things that are done in the name of the United States or done in the name of the place where I live that I also bear responsibility for, that might seem out of my control, but I could meet it in some way with a dance action. So for example, last year I was reading an article about a drone strike that the United States had done in Afghanistan that, you know, unintentionally killed 30 farmers. Well, when I pay my taxes, I often think about how I'm helping to feed children who need the benefit of a free lunch at school, or to preserve our public landscapes, or grow our national forests, or support the arts. You know, I convince myself that that's what my tax money is being used for, but in truth, it's being used for drones also. It's being used for weapons. And so I feel a certain amount of culpability in what the United States does, and what kinds of weapons are developed and used. And so last year I found myself looking to performance to try to help me take some responsibility for that. And I created a performance in collaboration with a wonderful visual artist and sculptor, Kevin Vanek, who he created 30 iron hearts, and we placed them in this plaza. It sort of accumulated over about an hour and a half that he was shaping these hearts out of iron. And I was performing a dance, a meditative dance, the entire time, with the intention that each of those hearts was honoring the life of one of those Afghan civilians who was hit by the drone strike, that I want to call at least remembrance to that and honor their memory in some way. But I have to say, just like I've been doing this work for so long, I still questioned, can dance really do anything, or can the arts really do anything in that situation? And what I came to was yes, because for me, dance is an expression of love. It's love that moves me. So there are many people who unfortunately feel moved to hate people that they've never met. And for some reason, I feel moved to love people I've never met. So in the most respectful way I could, I tried to allow that love to move me for that period of time in remembrance of them, just to at least hold space for honoring that they lived and were part of this world that sometimes we can forget the very human ways in which mechanized weapons are deployed.
Hi, I'm Melody Moody Thordis, and you're listening to the Mississippi Arts Hour podcast. You can also hear the show on MPB Think Radio every Sunday afternoon at 5 p.m. To hear all our conversations with creative Mississippians, be sure to subscribe to the Mississippi Arts Hour podcast on your favorite podcasting app.
Hi, I'm Walt Grayson. You can now listen to the wild, weird, and wonderful stories of Mississippi with Mile Marker.
Some of the big names that travel up and down the highways, obviously Elvis and Johnny Cash, and you have Jerry Lee Lewis, Carl Perkins.
Join me as we hit the roads of Mississippi on Mile Marker.
Johnny Cash suggested that Carl write a song called Blue Suede Shoes. That was all kind of created with Aaron Amory.
You can listen by going to mpbonline.org/radio or by using your favorite podcasting app.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast.
You're listening to the Mississippi Arts Hour on MPB Radio. Each week on the Arts Hour, representatives from the Mississippi Arts Commission speak with different creative people living in Mississippi. Today, I'm speaking with dancer and artist Candace Salyers. So, Candace, I want to talk a little bit more about your specific work in dance and your passion for site-specific work. So I want to hear about your experience with this, but moreover, I'd like to hear a little bit about, you know, why that is important to you, kind of your philosophy around site-specific work.
Great. Yeah, that's a wonderful question. I think that originally I started making site-specific work about 20 years ago, and the first site work I ever made was actually me inside a dumpster. And the audience had to, they could only initially see the very tips of my fingers. And I was really exploring these ideas about the way we treat things and people as disposable. But for me, I started to realize that there's something that dance in specific settings can bring to an audience's imagination that dance on a stage doesn't always bring in the same way. And I will say I certainly regard stages and theaters as specific sites. They are. So when we make a dance for a stage or a proscenium setting, that's a very specific site and engagement with the audience. And so really all works are site-specific in my experience, but I've been very interested in the ways in which dance can exist in sites where we don't always expect to see it, and the ways in which those unexpected dances can bring more to our poetic understanding of the human body and the connection of the human body to the rest of the living and constructed world.
I know this sounds off topic, but it really reminds me of the alternative comedy scene of the 80s and 90s. And I don't know how familiar you are with that, but all these comics performing in all these different site-specific places that were not the comedy clubs and were not the places that they were typically heard. But instead, it allowed their comedy itself to grow into what they called alternative comedy, because when they moved from the specific site, it kind of broke the rules and changed the rules and allowed that particular art form to expand in new ways. And so I know that's probably a random analogy, but the one that came to mind. So tell me about how performing in being intentional about performing in certain sites, how that has opened up the performance or the dance medium itself.
That is so interesting. Actually, I didn't know anything about the comedy scene, but I love that. I'm going to look more into that. I think it's similar in a way that, well, at least for me, I learned so much from dance practices. And I especially learn a lot when I take one dance and install it in many different locations. So I may or may not have made the dance itself there, but I work with that environment to transform the movement so that I'm starting to understand more of the meaning and meaningfulness in the movement because of what the site itself is telling me. And in the ways that the movement and the environment are in dialogue. But I also think I've thought a lot, both internationally and in the United States, about how my presence in various locations has different meanings. And for me, I think for a very long time, I felt like a stranger everywhere that I was, like including everywhere, you know, growing up. I think I always felt like a little bit of a stranger. And I decided that on the other side of that is friend. So I could either conceive of myself as stranger in each location, or I could conceive of myself as friend. Mm-hmm. And how does that affect my intention? Like you were saying, I think intention is a perfect word. How does that change my intention for how I am in that space? So certainly internationally, and I think you and I were speaking about this off the air a moment ago about in community partnerships, I want to be the best friend that I can be. And that can look many different ways in different situations and in different sites. But it is almost always about listening first. So really hearing literally from people, from the community, or hearing in a more metaphorical way in a site of what's there, what's already present, what's needed, what's desired, and where can I be of service there? Where can I be a good friend to that place or to those people?
So give us, by way of giving us an example, tell me a little bit more about your experience working in national parks. I think that'll help reflect kind of some of this site-specific work that we're talking about for
yes.
people listening.
When I was working on my PhD, actually, I unexpectedly completely changed my dissertation project. I had been researching a lot of intersections of performance process in dance and environmental philosophy and feminist philosophy, but I never expected to actually ground it in our national park system. So I started learning more about the establishment of parks, which also, as I've mentioned before, is a very complex history, including the ways in which those landscapes were lived in before the United States occupied them and called them public lands. I mean, there are very difficult histories that are part of even our amazing national parks. But one of the things that I love about the national parks is that I feel like there's a value system that encompasses beauty. So there's an established way of understanding and trying to make accessible the beauty of the environment for all people. I mean, I think at its highest ideal, it's trying to make these landscapes accessible for people. Now, there are also issues of accessibility in various ways, but by preserving them as public, you know, in the definition of public, then they belong to the people as a whole. And they also concern the people as a whole. So it relates a little bit back to that sense of responsibility that we were talking about in the last segment, that we all have responsibility for caring for them. So as part of my work, I was really looking at relationships and how dance can teach me more about how to be human and how to be human in relation to living environments that contain many, many different species, not assuming that humans are the dominant species, but really respecting that we all have a place. So in my experiments early on and in my performance research early on in national parks, I was looking at what can this landscape teach me and what can the dialogue between my movement and this landscape teach me. So I was working with a very specific dance, so there was very specific choreography, and I performed it for days and days and days in each national park that I visited, and I visited five very different sites. And so I learned a lot of philosophical lessons and also physical lessons in each of those different landscapes, but it revealed to me more about what I think is possible for the United States and for how we hold ourselves to responsibility and also to beauty, answering to beauty. And I just at the time thought, oh my gosh, if everybody could come to national parks, we wouldn't need these weapons. We wouldn't need to feel that we have to be more offensive or defensive than at peace. You know, there seemed like to me, there's something about these landscapes that represent the best of what we can be as a nation. So, for example, in one place, I'm very afraid of heights, just as a person. And in Acadia National Park, I was dancing on this very high cliff over the ocean, and I was so scared the entire time. And I remember looking down and seeing this tiny, tiny little red spider that had no problem scampering over the rocks, no problem being upside down all around, and no fear. And at one point in the dance, I kneel. And so it just like the philosophical lesson that came out of that for me was right to remember not to be afraid of heights, metaphorical or physical, but to be willing to bow down, to be willing to kneel and receive. And in another park, I was actually in Shiloh in Tennessee, and I was doing the same dance in this area that's known as Bloody Pond. And all of the sudden, I could feel the choreography shifting as I was performing it. And it, my wrists started to curl a different way. And I started feeling like my movement became very horse-like. And I wasn't sure what that was about. But then after the performance, after I'd been doing that for several hours, I went over and read the placard that was beside that land. And it said that that actually was the area where the bodies of deceased horses were gathered and burned. So there's a way that dance, I think, can make accessible to us deeper understanding than we even realize. And then at Joshua Tree, I was dancing in this dry riverbed, and I felt so calm. And I realized, like, right, of course, this riverbed half of the year holds rushing water. So surely it can hold me and all of the turmoil or the rushing that's going on inside my being. And it really made me think, okay, this is what I want to be in the world also, that I want to be like this for other people. I want to be like a riverbed that can embrace them and contain them no matter what they're going through. So it had a probably more profound impact on me than the ever I had on the sites. But I think that that's part of what we carry into the world is the ways in which our experiences have shaped us.
Hi, I'm Melody Moody Thortis, and you're listening to the Mississippi Arts Hour podcast. You can also hear the show on MPB Think Radio every Sunday afternoon at 5 p.m. To hear all our conversations with creative Mississippians, be sure to subscribe to the Mississippi Arts Hour podcast on your favorite podcasting app.
Hi, I'm Ryder Taff, Portfolio Manager at New Perspectives, a fee-only financial advisory and co-host of Money Talks. Each week, we take your personal finance questions and tell you about a money topic we hope you find helpful. Money Talks can be heard Tuesdays at 9 a.m. on MPB Think Radio. Podcasts can be found on our website, money.mpbonline.org, or on your smart device's podcasting platform.